Major sighting here.
Hello, everyone. This is Jerry Pippin, and the 38th Annual Symposium, the MUFON Symposium, was just held in Denver, Colorado. And we have on the line with us from her studio in Boulder, Jane Swartley, our correspondent producer. Jane, same place you normally do the editing for our shows, and you do a great job, by the way.
Well, thank you.
Welcome to the show.
Thanks.
MUFON this year, I understand, had lots of mainstream media.
Yes, it was unprecedented. All of the local main channels and the Denver Post, and they were even surprised that they had gotten that kind of attention. But
well, the big news, I guess, it's been in Denver for a little while, several years. They're going back on the road like they used to.
Right. Next year's symposium is going to be in San Jose, California. The thing that strikes me the most is the importance of never throwing anything away, and that may not make much sense, but of the 10 or 12 speakers they had this year, two of the topics had to do with material that could have gotten thrown out, or just lost in the shuffle over the years. They wouldn't have had anything to talk about if they hadn't come across this material by accident.
So it was a validation for pack rats, pro pack rats.
Exactly. Yes. In fact, one of the speakers, Michael Nelson, who was a policeman at the time. He's an archaeologist right now and a college professor, I believe. But he was in the process of his job was to shred old paper evidence. And
so, in other words, he as a cop, he worked on cold case files. Is that what you're saying?
No, this was actually stuff that he was. His task was to destroy this. Get rid of this evidence. That sounds bad. I don't mean destroy evidence, but
after they had finished, after it had run its course in the judicial system.
Exactly. It was considered trash. But he got interested in this material and asked if he could keep it and was told that he could. And that this is the Portage, Ohio UFO case.
Yeah, now, that's an interesting case. Why don't you tell me a little bit about that? Did you get a chance to hear that lecture?
I did.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it took place in 1966. At night, two Portage police deputies had stopped to investigate a suspicious-looking car by the side of the road. And this particular car, I mention it now because it comes into the story later, and I won't give too many details, but it was such an odd car that while they were, and it was empty of people, that while they were looking it over, here they saw this giant light in the farmer's field not too far away, which they then began to chase. And they forgot all about the odd car. It wound up being, because they had their sirens going at the wee hours of the morning and waking people up, and then therefore those people who weren't already up looking at the bright light, it ended up having many, many, many witnesses. And the chase, I don't know how many miles it went, but it went from Portage, Ohio to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, however long that is. But he has conducted a lot of experiments on the site itself, and he has a piece of material, and I wasn't clear how he got this in his hands, but he said he had it for 20 years, this metallic.
Well, it was probably picked up by the police's evidence.
Well, it could have been, but Michael Nelson himself had it in his possession. Finally, he has it's in a state lab right now being analyzed, and a couple of days after he took it, he received a call from this lab wanting to know how, if his kids had ever handled it, how much he had handled it, and so on, because it was so seriously radioactive that they weren't going to give it back to him. So it's a whatever it is, it has very strange properties and has maintained its radioactivity.
But he doesn't think he has any damage himself.
Well, he joked about it, but I guess there's nothing he can do
about
it.
He's not glowing in the dark. You didn't say
no, he's bald. I don't know if that has anything to do with it, but
they never really figured out what this light
was. They never really did, but if I could come back to that car for a minute, it had many radio antennas on it. It had strange insignia on it, and it had a lot of radio equipment inside of it. Now, as I say, they forgot about it in their chase, but later, in interviewing witnesses. One of the witnesses was a woman who was contacted by basically men in black. She said a few minutes after she had seen this thing. And
now you're talking about new evidence on old things that were never thrown away. Kathleen Martin and Stanton Friedman. He helped her write that book. He wrote the foreword and advised her. She has new evidence on the Betty and Barney Hill case. We're going to do a show later, so we don't want to cover too much, but at the same time...
Well, just briefly, what her talk consisted of, a lot of anyway, were actual audio...
From the hypnotherapist.
And they were... I thought they were very moving to hear, because the emotion was there. There was no masking that, the emotion that as they went through remembering. And in fact, the doctor had to stop the sessions a couple of times because Barney especially was...
Well, I mean, when you say very moving, were they terrorized or... or was it more of an emotional thing like... other than fear, something
else?
Well,
I think it was fear and humiliation and...
Humiliation?
This was when they were being examined physically, their bodies being examined. And it was a feeling of being totally vulnerable and no way out.
Well, I feel that way every year when I get a physical.
Well, I that maybe that's why I could relate to it.
Yeah, so I guess that would be understandable. Did they describe the beings on these tapes?
They did, and surprisingly, they were, although not exactly what you would call humanoid, they were surprisingly humanoid. Certainly not grays with giant eyes. They were unusual looking, and
unusual looking in what way did they say?
Well, at one point, this is kind of a little strange. At one point, they commented that they had very long noses and black hair, which doesn't fit with the usual alien description. But then, in other parts, they said that they had no hair. And they had kind of a snub nose.
So by that, I would draw the conclusion that maybe there was more than one species there.
Well, yeah, there were the beings who actually abducted them were. They said they were about 5 feet tall, and you're right. These could have been the long-nosed, black-haired guys. The ones who examined them were shorter, and then the one who seemed to be the boss was shorter still, and he exhibited a lot of hostility. And the drawing that was made by a forensic artist does look a little bit more like the standard gray that we think about, except not with his eyes weren't that exaggerated anyway. Could be mistaken for a human at a distance
now,
in the dark.
Let's talk a little bit about. About these missing papers, Bob Pratt, he passed away a couple of years ago or so. A year and a half or so later, they found these papers. How come it took so long to look through the papers?
Well, I guess they were given to MUFON by his family.
You found that interesting. I do, too. Pratt was associated with MUFON. Now, exactly how did the Pratt papers surface?
I think truckloads of material like this given to them. They're just starting to digitize. So they don't know what they've got, really. James Carrion came across them, and he probably recognized the name. I'm sure he did, and started looking through and thought that they were important. And he gave them to Brad Sparks. I don't know if you know who he is. From Cars.
Yeah, Sparks actually spoke on MJ-12, I believe. That was the main topic.
Right. Well, yeah. The title of his speech was New Revelations on MJ-12.
Jane, we have a little bit of Brad Sparks' presentation here. If you want to hear the entire presentation, you can get it either on DVD or audio tape through the MUFON site. I like this part because it talks about some of our regular cast of characters, including Rick Doty and the Avery. Listen closely.
It turns out that Bob Pratt, the late UFO reporter and former editor-in-chief of the MUFON UFO Journal, had recorded a number of secret telephone and personal meeting conversations with Roswell investigator William Moore in the early 80s, and the topic of these conversations was MJ-12, and it was concerning the information that Moore had just received from Air Force OSI, Air Force Office of Special Investigations, Special Agent Richard C. Doty. And Doty had revealed the information about MJ-12. And furthermore, Doty had connected MJ-12 with Project Aquarius. Now, the problem here is that this information from Doty and then Doty to Moore and Moore to Pratt, Bob Pratt, was 2 to 3 years before the MJ-12 documents turned up in Jamie Chandra's mailbox in December 1984. So the question immediately arises, how is it that this information is already available 3 years before the documents show up? And then secondly, why is it connected with Project Aquarius? And then thirdly, as it will turn out, Project Aquarius and the Project Aquarius documents are explicitly stated to be related to the Eisenhower briefing document that turned up in Jamie Chandra's mailbox in December 1984. Now, let me give you a little bit of a background on Doty and the way this all came about. 1980, the Roswell Incident book by Berlitz and Moore first came out, was published in June and through September 1980. And during the book tour for promotion of the book, Moore spoke at a radio station in Omaha, Nebraska, around September 4th, 1980. At the end of his radio interview, and as he was leaving the radio station, a telephone call came in, and Moore heard on the other end of the line a guy who said he was a colonel in the Air Force at nearby base, who said that something to the effect that you seem to know more about what is really going on than anyone else, you know, we have ever heard of before, something to that effect. And he wanted to get together and meet with Moore, but Moore couldn't do it because he was on his way to Washington, D.C. for the Smithsonian UFO Symposium, which was on September 6th. So Moore forgot all about this, and then on his way back from the symposium, the Smithsonian Symposium on September 8th, he spoke at an Albuquerque radio station. And at the end of that interview, as he was getting ready to leave the radio station, same thing happened. The same guy or someone similar said exactly the same thing to him on this telephone call, saying, "You seem to know more about what's really going on than anyone else, and we'd like to meet with you," so on and so forth. This time, Moore finally decided to try to set up a meeting, and about 3 weeks later, he gets a call from Richard Doty, Special Agent of Air Force OSI. And then Doty sets up a meeting on September 30th, 1980, at which point Doty introduces himself and explains a little bit about what he's interested in. And there's a reference to the colonel that had called and how they're going to have a meeting sometime soon, which happened the next month. Well, the interesting thing, and this brings me into direct involvement with the situation, with the case, is that Doty claimed that he was friends with Stanton Friedman and Brad Sparks, and that they would vouch for him. And Moore was quite shocked at this because he and Stan had been working for well over a year, almost 2 years, on investigating the Roswell incident. And it's thanks to Stan, an old friend of mine from a long ways back, that the Roswell incident has been rescued from obscurity, because it was his initiative to investigate the contact about Marcel, Major Marcel, that led to the whole opening of the Roswell incident. And I'm digressing on a digression here, but I should point out that I started out as a skeptic of Roswell and have been for quite a long time, and I have to admit now that I was probably wrong. There really seems to be something to Roswell, and I hope to be able to get into it a little later in the talk. But anyway, so Doty is name-dropping me and Stan, and more naturally, after the meeting, he calls up Stan and says, gee, have you ever heard of this guy, Richard Doty? He's supposed to be a special agent in the Air Force OSI. And Stan says, he's never heard of this guy before, doesn't know him. So then Moore calls me up, and he says, have you ever heard of this guy, Richard C. Doty, in the Air Force OSI? I said, no. A name sort of sounds familiar from, you know, Project Blue Book or Green Fireballs or something like that. It was Edward Doty. That was all I could think of. And I said, no, I've never heard of this guy. So then Bill says to me, well, he said he knows you and Stan, and Stan doesn't know of anything about him either. So apparently it was one of these tricks or tests that Doty has become known for over the years, where he says some outrageous thing, you go check it out, and it turns out to be completely false.
That was a little bit of the presentation by Brad Sparks at MUFON in Denver, the 38th Annual Symposium. We're talking with Jane Swartley, our reporter, our correspondent. In fact, MJ-12 people were all over the place, Jane. Stanton Friedman, he's done a little on MJ-12 before, and Ryan Wood. Ryan held a workshop.
Right.
Hey, I think that's a good way to end our report on the MUFON convention, actually a symposium is the way they like to refer to it. Next year it'll be in San Jose, probably about the same time. They usually have it in late July or August. A date will be announced and a place, I am sure. We could have talked about a lot of other people, but really, in summary, Jane, I think, basically, you summed it up originally. Write it down and save your notes. The MUFON people are making good use of them these days. Another thing I think that came out of the convention that we haven't talked about is the fact that MUFON is moving into abduction investigations. For a while, MUFON kind of ran the other way, but now they're suddenly interested. We'll have to see how their research goes over the next year or two, huh? Jane, thanks very much for joining us and talking to us about the weekend in Denver at the MUFON Symposium. That's it for this show. Jane Swartley was our correspondent in Colorado. I'm Jerry Pippin in Oklahoma.
Where are you?
Oh, no, never mind. Thanks for listening. Cheers.